Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Welcome to this late night panel. I really appreciate, or we really appreciate you all making the effort. There we go. I feel like I'm a bit volume now. I just like to do a quick survey beforehand. I did this last year as well. How many people know Ghostfire Gaming or what we do? Oh, awesome.
Hey.
For a smaller crowd, I feel like that's grown on last year, which is really awesome. How many people know Story Brewers and what they do? Nice. Excellent. How many people are aware of our podcast, The Eldritch Lorecast, if you're a fan? Yes! And that was exact reaction last year. All right, we want to apologize to you because there won't be another episode of The Lorecast next week because this is it. So welcome. Cool, so you know what the drill is. For everybody else, enjoy. I have to do the podcast intro. 3, 2, 1. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of the Eldritch Lorecast, the number one tabletop RPG podcast of all conventions. That's right, especially the ones we're not at, because people put us in their ears as they walk around the show floor. My name is Ben Byrne, and I am joined very gratefully this week by James Hake, Phil Beckwith, V. Hendro and Haley Gordon. Haley, would you like to introduce yourself and a bit about what you do?
Yeah, so I'm Haley. As mentioned, I'm one half of Story Brewers Role Playing, and we design games together, games that are like Good Society, which is a Jane Austen RPG, or our newest game, which is called Fight with Spirit, and it's a sports drama RPG. And since there's just two of us, we straddle many roles, but aside from game design, my specialties are in the very interesting areas of shipping, distribution, a bit of finance, and a bit of marketing as well.
I'm V. Hendro, lovely to meet you all. I'm the other half of Story Brewers Role Playing, and I get all the fun tasks like layout, graphic design, working with the artists that we get on the project, and also we share the game design, which is best part of it.
Yeah, hi, I'm Phil. I am the only half of PB Publishing. I used to work with Ghostfire Gaming as the head of Tabletop RPG and have recently moved into my own stuff. I'm a writer first and foremost, a project manager and jack of all trades, as a lot of us really are.
Mm-hmm. As you kind of need to be.
Yeah, as we'll discuss.
As we'll discuss. James.
Hey, I'm James Hake. I'm a game designer and a writer. I work with Ghostfire Gaming on things like Ethereal Expanse and Grim Hollow. I have worked with Wizards of the Coast and Critical Role and Kobold Press and a handful of other wonderful, wonderful presses. And I just this very morning started my own YouTube channel about game design, writing essays on how you two can do very good, high quality game design.
Nice. And if you don't know me, my name's Ben Byrne. As mentioned, I am the creative content director for Ghostfire Gaming. We do the Eldritch Lorecast, which is our podcast, video content helping people be better GMs, but also game designers. And I'm also the creative director of Grim Hollow, which is our dark fantasy setting. But a lot goes into these books. I really wanted this conversation to be one that is pretty holistic. In terms of what goes into creating a product like the Grim Hollow Campaign Guide or any other product that this panel has worked on. So maybe Phil, as someone, I mean, Haley mentioned as well, and Joey obviously from the writing side of things, but just taking a quick holistic approach or look at what goes into a product. I know there's writing and game design. I know there's editing that kind of goes on top of that. I know that there's layout to make it look nice. I know that there's art to make it, appealing and set a tone, and then manufacturing and fulfillment. What am I missing, and how do those pieces sort of start to fit together? Where do you start assembly?
Right. I can only really speak from my own experiences. I'm sure everybody does it differently. So I think the way I sort of look at it and the way I approach it is really in sort of four different pillars or phases. I tend to conceptualize and do the writing and editing all sort of as part of a creation phase. From that point, the second phase is about bringing in, making it pretty, making it into something, really developing it into something, the production phase. And then the third phase is, the proofing and taking what you've done and really making it a solid product, something that people are willing to pay for and something that, they've paid good money for this and you really want to give them the best product that you can. And then there's a fourth layer that sort of just weaves through everything. And Hayley, I think you touched on that earlier, is a lot of what you do there is the business side of it. Mm. And I think a lot of creatives, when they first come into this space, don't really take that or give that enough credit for what it is. And it's really the thing that takes, I guess, a hobby product into the next level.
And you might say a homebrew to hardcover.
You know, I really see that the most important phase or pillar of it all is that business pillar.
Yeah.
Especially when you're talking about marketing and things like that.
Yeah, sure. Hayley and V, I'm not down with the early lore of story brewers in terms of how you went literally from kind of homebrew, which is maybe not quite accurate because you're developing your own games, right? You're not just hacking things onto another system. How did you find that journey from going and what were the things that you discovered, new skills, let's say, you needed to pick up along the way?
Well, and touching on a little bit what you mentioned, what is missing, I think one of the core tenets that we work by is the playtesting phase, mm-hmm. because that is, no matter if it is a whole new system that we make or it is, like a scenario, having players run through that and playtesting and iterating on that cycle is so important to what we do and the quality of what you make. And I think the other way that we're subtly different in terms of our workflow process is because a lot, it's just like most of it is us two, and we can be having all these conversations all at once. There is much more of a synthesis that we can be thinking about when we're game designing. Well, what's the product constraints and how does that affect the design? The character sheets that we're making, we can play test iterations of them, the layout, what's the best way to present the information that is easily rocked by people on the table. So there's a lot of fluidity sometimes. We're moving to back and forth in those separate areas a bit easier. And that's, I think, very helpful, especially through that lens of then play testing those things and having iterations of it after that. So the lore, I guess, of how we as story brewers began was that we played a role-playing game, and we decided, and many of you probably did, of making our own role-playing game. That seems like a fun idea. Then we made a terrible role-playing game. It did not work. It was a James Bond spy themed, but terrible game. That lasted one playtest session. And then after that, we tinkered around with smaller things, game jams, and then we're like, let's make a game again, bigger, better, maybe. We did a PBTA game, ran that on Kickstarter, crowdfunded that, then used kind of the proceeds of that to reinvest back into making even more games, which was Good Society, and that went really well on the crowdfunding front, so that then that made us think, oh, maybe we can like start doing this passion project as a part-time thing, and then slowly was a Hayley part-time, then it was both of us part-time, then Hayley went full-time into games, and I went full-time into games, and here we are.
You touched on something there, I'm going to go off script a little bit, I'm sorry, which I thought was really interesting, was playtesting, which has been something that has been kind of in the conscious of the hobby a lot lately with, you know, playtest packets from Wizards dropping every 10 weeks or so, and a lot of conversation about them getting 30,000 people sending in their surveys. And how did they, you know, we spoke with Peter Lee on the podcast a couple of episodes ago about how he, for D&D Next, what became 5th edition, was able to pull out useful playtest information from just streams and streams of data. that's what I'm curious about is, at the scale that, you know, we produce games, you produce games, and I'm sure most people in this room who are hoping to break in are starting to produce games, how do you playtest? How much is enough playtesting? How do you get your game out to ensure that it's been playtested by a lot of different people? What was that process for you?
So playtesting is something that we do continuously throughout the process, as V mentioned. And the thing about playtesting is that it is a process that theoretically could never end, because even when you have put your heart and soul and time and effort into a game and it becomes something that's in book and it's published, there's still things about it that you really could change. And so for us, playtesting is really about like the as much as it's about like getting hard concrete feedback from other people, it's also just about as much as the vibe and like, does the game sing? Is it singing? Is it opera? It better be loud. and so a lot of our playtesting tends to go through different phases. We tend to start with like a very loose playtest where probably the game's not even done yet. It's just the vibe of the thing. We kind of give that a role and see where the heart of the game is. We'll then move on to like a sort of a version of the game that we'll know will never be the final version, but it's closer, to kind of test the key ideas and refine things. From there, we usually go into a blind playtesting section where we'll get other people to run the game and give us recordings or even written feedback. Recordings are better because you can see when people are getting confused or stuck or just like, hey, I hate this, can we just like not do it? And then after that, we usually will actually go back again into running the game ourselves in what we hope will be the final version of the game. And at that point, we're looking for anything that's like, you know, little niggles, you know, like a little rock under your foot when you're trying to like walk with the game and just checking that the game really feels good to us. And we'll usually be doing that like literally all the way up until we're done with editing, because even when you're writing down rules and making sure those rules are edited and expressed properly, then you need to test that they're written and expressed properly.
Gotcha. How do you get the game into other people's hands? To like, do you bring it to conventions and have other people run it? Do you give it to friends? How do you play test, I suppose, at a scale that feels satisfying to, you know, then let it out and reach those final stages?
Yeah, so we'll usually use basically every resource available to us. So we definitely take it to conventions. We have a great Discord community that is really useful for blind playtesting, but also really early buy playtesting. Like, don't care if it doesn't work, we'll play it. I'm like, thank you. And we'll tend to even just like go out on even social media or our newsletter and be like, hey, want to play this game? Just give it a shot. You know, you might have fun. And then lastly, of course, once it does get to a crowdfunding stage, the people who have crowdfunded the campaign usually quite keen to get involved with the playtesting element of it as well. And that's really like, even if you're just, you know, crowdfunding on a small scale, it really is a good way to just get people who are willing to give your game the time to get the feedback needs.
Yeah, and that variety of people, if it's like established gaming groups or if it's that a convention setting, all those different groups have really different vibes and different kind of situations, and that's really helpful to see for playtesting for your game, whether that it holds up in those different contexts of how role-playing games are happening.
Gotcha. I want to ask more questions there, but we're not going to have time if we just spend this whole panel on playtesting. I'm like, how do you get into a convention? How do you get onto the show floor? Maybe we'll ask that if we get back to it later. Because playtesting, to my understanding, is kind of the middle of the process, right? Towards the end, but then there's another part after that that we'll get to. I want to bring it back to the start, or start-ish, with James Hake, who has not only written for a lot of products, but has also managed writing teams, because, you know, to write, I don't even know how many words a standard adventure is for Wizards or Critical Role or us. How do you manage that team? What's that process?
Yeah. Managing writing teams is nothing that I was ever formally trained on. It's something that I've learned how to do decently by doing it bad a lot. And often in ways that stressed me and my colleagues out until I finally figured out how to do it well. And started reading books on like management for things that aren't games. And the way it goes is that you really need to structure this out if you want to bring other people onto your project, right? If you're doing something on your own, you can be as freeform and as formless as you want to be, because the only person you're beholden to is yourself. But once you have a vision and you need to collaboratively share that vision with other creative people, you need to make sure that you're all on the same page, that your expectations are clear, that you are getting what you want, but also that your collaborators are getting what they want, because this is not a sort of master-servant relationship, even if you're paying them, right? Like, they need to work to spec, But they're also creative people doing creative work, and so there has to be at least a little bit of give and take in this situation. And well, ultimately from there, it becomes something that I think anyone working on any project in any field comes to recognize, right? There are deadlines and there are deliverables, and you break your big creative concept down into tiny chunks that and you give chunks that make sense to work together to individual people. So it's not like they're all working completely in echo chambers. You want them to be able to talk to each other. Sorry, not echo chambers, but like, you know, sensory deprivation tanks, basically. you silo your creatives away too much, then all of a sudden your book is, you know, incomprehensible, it's uncohesive, yeah. It's a mess, and you give yourself a lot of work as sort of the managing editor, as the person with whom the buck stops, to all of a sudden turn all of this quite disparate material into something that all gels together. And that process is actually quite difficult, mostly because unless you've done it a lot, the process of finding people whose creative styles mesh is pretty obtuse. How do you find someone who is a creative match for your project?
Well, speaking of finding people who are a creative match for your project, how do you find people who are a creative match for your project? And I mean that, you know, kind of literally, like, how do you find freelancers that you feel comfortable working with, even if you've never worked with them before, even if you're, mm-hmm. how does somebody kind of vibe check themselves to get you to look at them to be hired onto a project as a freelancer?
Yeah, I think this is a pretty different answer depending on if you are a small indie operation or even a small company operation like Ghostfire is.
Sure.
Much less a big company operation like, say, Wizards of the Coast is. Because when you're working on something small and indie, and generally your deadlines are at least a little bit more amorphous than you are in a big corporate structure, you have the ability to just kind of jam with one or two or three other people. But once you start having really hard deadlines, this needs to go to the printer now, otherwise we're going to miss, you know, this quarter's funding goal or something like that. Then you need to have people who you absolutely 100% know can hit deadlines.
Sure.
Otherwise you are in for a bad time. Because the trade-off, the balance that you're always trying to strike, like we were talking about before the panel, is how good a writer are you versus how much of an egomaniac are you? Can you write to spec? Can you do the things that I need of you? And if you're too much of that, it doesn't matter how good a writer you are. You're hard to work with, and I would much rather have someone who needs a lot of mentorship, who needs, or who is more of a collaborative thing rather than, okay, I trust you, go off, do your own thing. Just go do it. I trust you'll bring it back to me just fine. Mm-hmm. I would rather be more hands-on with someone who is eager to also be collaborative with me than someone who is an absolute auteur genius who will go off into a cave somewhere and then turn in something that may or may not be what I want at the end of the day.
I mean, I've really appreciated that from you as someone who, you know, within our own projects more recently, we've been able to work together more directly. And the feedback that you sent me, I said this, I don't know if I've said this on the Lorecast yet, but I said, you and Sean both kicked my ass over the last couple of weeks as a writer. And I guess for people wanting to get into writing in the RPG space when you're freelancing for somebody else is recognizing that you are a student.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm also self-taught in terms of the style of 5e, copying kind of formatting and different styles out of the SRD to ensure that it's aligning with the language that Wizards use. And I didn't know as much as I thought I did at all until I got that feedback from you and Sean on two different projects. And I was like, okay, this is a incredible learning opportunity here for me to take on this feedback, make the changes that I need, and then send you back questions in the form of like, all right, this is what I'm thinking. I fixed these things in this direction. These are the reasons that I've made these creative decisions. You know, what do you think? I can go one way or the other, or you can make the changes as needed. It's been a fun collaborative process.
And that's an incredibly specific thing, that sort of process of learning what the system sounds like, how the system talks, what its syntax is.
Mm.
It's very specific to things like D&D and Pathfinder and, say, Monty Cook's Cypher system and all of the systems that are well-established and need people to write material for it.
Mm.
If you're... I mean, I'll let you guys talk about what it's like to make your own game, because that's a whole different can of worms that I know almost nothing about. But what I do with you and what I do with the other Ghostfire writers is kind of... When I was first doing work like this, big studio work, I was afforded an incredible opportunity by Chris Perkins, who I like idolized, right, as a young author, and I still kind of idolize now. And in a move that I've come to increasingly learn is uncommon for Wizards, because their pace is relentless in terms of product release. He sat down with the two freelancers on Waterdeep Dragon Heist, me and James Intricasso, who's now kicking ass at MCDN, and was just like, okay, we are going to meet for half an hour every Friday. You're going to show me what you've written this week. We have this schedule. Let's keep to the schedule. Go ahead and show it to me, because I know you two guys have never worked with Wizards before. There's a lot for you to learn. And I want to make sure that we are all on track this entire time. And so every week we basically had like a writer's masterclass with the master, and learned how to do this stuff. And I've heard a lot of stories after this of projects with the same creative team, the same like in-house creative team, creative leads, stuff like that, where that absolutely was not the case.
Sure.
Rime of the Frost Maiden had 13 freelancers on it, amazing designers. And they were kind of left out in the cold, no pun intended, because there were so many of them and the needs of the book were so great and the pace of production was picking up and COVID had just happened. And it was just this incredible confluence of events that made it impossible to have that mentorship experience that, like, I do not think I would be half the game designer I am today if I hadn't received that from someone whose like skill I trusted deeply.
It's almost like the Jedi Padawan relationship of like, you know, now the student has become the master and passes that knowledge on to the next one. Because I find I'm kind of in this weird in between where I have people asking me for advice on writing and I can give my opinion, but then you and Sean kick the crap out of me and I go like, oh, actually I'm still a student, you know, always be open to learning, I think is important.
Yeah.
Also, why wasn't there a heist in Waterdeep Dragon Heist? No, just kidding.
If you want me to get into that, I'll get into that, but we will be there all day.
I want to flip over to the other side because, you know, hopefully there's some folk in this room who are also interested in the art side of things, because I know that there's a lot of people who are passionate about games, but they're artists and not necessarily writers, which I believe is kind of your area. Do you use freelance artists on Storybrewer
books?
Yes,
we do. We have, because our games are all so different. You know, they all have really different themes. And so we always try to find artists who can further sort of the feel and the aesthetics of the game. And so, I mean, we find artists mostly through online. Who doesn't? Now with Twitter gone, what are we doing?
can you, well, that's what I want to know. Can you be a bit more specific?
Yeah,
in terms
absolutely.
Of like, where do you find artists so that people know where to be if they want to?
Yeah, we used to honestly just do a public call out on Twitter, say we're working on this game, where, you know, it's a Regency role-playing game, who's interested in doing some Regency art? And people are pretty active on, I think, social media, a lot of artists do, and they just reply, like, here's my portfolio. And I did that too when I was starting at freelancing graphic design. I just... when I saw those, I put my portfolio in and they'll get in touch if you're a good match to what they're doing.
Sure.
Yeah, and that's basically, like, it's that simple. I think the hard part, I think, with getting together the art is, one, I guess, finding good people who have, and then also because you're just meeting online for the first time, getting on the same page, having a chat about what you're trying to achieve, what the game's about, is the next step. And I think everyone probably does that differently. For me, I'm not an artist myself, so I have a lot of trust in the people that I'm working with. I know they know what they're doing, and it's sort of like I will take a lot of their expertise and go with it. While still like providing what I can about because I'll know the stuff that's about the project, about what the themes are, what we're trying to do in the stories. You know, some guidelines, like we want there to be diversity in our art, so could you please make sure that's the case? And a few things like that, but mostly I think a lot of artists, I do ask them, do you prefer a lot of guidance or do you prefer to take the lead? Do you want me to do some thumbnail sketches that you can work off, or are you happy to, like, you know, go for it?
Yeah.
And, you know, different people are different. They all work. I think this is the thing with freelancers. Everyone has a different workflow. But having those conversations up front really help you start to build what's a good working relationship. And I'm on both sides of that, where I've worked with artists, but I also freelance myself as a graphic designer. And I know when I take work on with indie publishers themselves, there is that discussion of, hey, how do we want this to look like? And how do you want to work together? Is one of the very first things we do. I've also done work as a graphic designer for like Monty Cook, Darrington Press, for like bigger outfits. And those are very different in that they usually already know what their workflow is, and they'll give you templates and that sort of thing.
Sure.
Whereas when you're working independently, there's much more of a back and forth of like, how do we want this to look like?
And how did you get found as a graphic designer? Like, is that the same kind of process through social media connections, or is there, because, you hear that saying, which is, and I'm going to get this wrong, it's like luck is opportunity versus preparedness, which I think is really applicable to, you know, you said pretty casually, you know, they just might see your portfolio if you apply online. It's like, yeah, you need to have a portfolio.
Yeah,
you know, what does a graphic designer need to have in terms of that preparedness?
So I was self-taught as a graphic designer. I learned doing our own projects. And then when I decided, oh, maybe I'll just do a couple of freelance things to kind of learn a bit more, then I put together everything I'd done for ourselves and just started up a basic bare bones website. And then as you gain experience, you can add to that portfolio, I guess. I think I get most of my inquiries through either they've seen one of my books out in the wild.
Right.
And they're like, oh, who did design that? And then that's where they search me up. Or
yeah.
They get to my portfolio online and look through it, and they contact me through that.
Yeah, okay, gotcha. Because Phil, before you were working for Ghostfire, you were, you know, you've got PB Publishing, which is where you are now. My impression of what happened, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that you started putting some things on DM's Guild and DriveThruRPG, and then kind of met someone else like Clint, who was doing it, and then met MT Black, and you know, you kind of Joe Rasso, who works for Ghostfire now, and you kind of, I don't know, like skydivers catching hands in the air, you all kind of like came together. Thank you. How did that process actually work, you know, in terms of finding people to work with and building out what felt like a team, whether it's just for a quick kind of short project or a bigger project?
Oh, going back to the deep, dark old days of 2016, I think, when DM's Guild was first introduced. I think I remember jumping on there probably about halfway through 2016.
Sure.
And just putting out my first really crappy adventure, full of puns and full of bad writing, and it was no layout whatsoever. And I think I was very lucky in that my good friend Jeff Stevens reached out to me and said, hey, come join me, this DM's Guild creators Facebook group.
Right.
So we jumped on there, and it was a budding community that had grown over 6 to 7 months. And during the end of 2016, a lot of people were starting to reach out and make connections and starting to band together and realizing that collaborative projects were actually a much, I wouldn't say easier task, but a shared experience, and getting a lot more voices into a book was beneficial.
Mm.
And everyone came into it with lots of different skills too. Some people might come into it with some editing skills as well.
Right.
Some people might come into it with some layout skills, right? And everyone brings a little piece of something else to the project.
Yeah.
And that's just saving costs. That's again, bringing more more voice to it.
Mm-hmm.
And in general, just lifting each other up and creating a much better product than what we had previously seen in the early days of the DM school. Things started to become more professional through leaning on each other.
Right, yeah. Because that's kind of where I wanted to go with this panel is how do you build a Voltron different people's skill set? And I suppose it starts with finding community.
Connecting with others, yeah. Connecting with your peers and uplifting them, and they'll uplift you.
Sure, for sure. And then once you have a book, the task is far from complete, as we know, for anybody who's throwing something on DM's Guild and just seen it go disappear into the oceans of time. Hayley, maybe this is a question for you to start with in terms of marketing and getting the word out, making yourself appear on the public stage to try to get interest in your project and build an audience.
So our approach to marketing is and sort of has always been very community focused. So basically, the first kind of way that we had to like form that community was through our first crowdfunding campaign. And then sort of when we had done that, wanting to bring those, support those people, not just in delivering the high quality product, but also in answering any questions they had around it, in having tutorial videos, in running games for that community, and bring those people forward into our next project. And hopefully your next project's gonna be bigger than your first one, which means your community sort of naturally grows with that as well. And so we're sort of a bit different in that we are not the most active or best on social media, although we try to, let people know when we're doing something that we think they'll find exciting. But we're really there to foster our community through supporting them through the content we create, through running a Discord community where people can, reach out to us and also each other and like connect and have fun playing games. Because really, that's actually what we're all here for, have fun playing games. And just through making sure that people who are playing the game are having a good experience as much as possible. And reaching out to them through our newsletter. So that's kind of been our approach to marketing. And it's gone fairly well for us. I think the result is sort of like a smaller but more invested group of people who sort of are more likely to follow you from your first project to your second project and onwards, rather than always trying to like reach for new people who might or might not be interested in you. So it's sort of a bit of a different approach probably some other companies have.
Maybe also the other thing that we do that just popped into my mind is thinking about marketing as part of your product of like what is the hook or the top line of your whatever it is that you're making, and making sure that's like a really unique or cool proposition. It doesn't have to reinvent the wheel. You can be on the shoulders of giants, but that it offers something different that people actually want and value.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's not dissimilar to Ghostfire's story in terms of like we did that first Kickstarter around Grim Hollow, which was, the spark that lit the fire that started the forest to burn. And that Star Wars quote is. And it sounds like it's kind of similar. It's like, if you have that project there and it's catching eyeballs, it can kind of spark that community that becomes a Discord community. Mm. I've heard a lot about... I want to say the words brand ambassadors, but I don't think that's actually correct because I think brand ambassador is a paid person, but kind of like people who will go to bat for you because they feel passionate about the thing that you've made. Mm-hmm. And trying to find those people is a strange and weird alchemy that I don't necessarily have the answer to, but that's just interesting to me that it feels kind of similar.
Since we're such a small, I guess, indie kind of operation in that there's two of us, it tends to be quite personal. So the people that, someone might externally look at and go, oh, that's like a brand advocate, are usually people who we just like really like and just play a lot of games with. And, people we, reach out to and connect with personally, and they find something in their games that they connect to. And so I think that personal like community is worthwhile putting investment into, even though sometimes it can feel like, oh, one-on-one relationships aren't very like
effective because it's just one person, that is, you know, they'll pass on the love. They do, yeah.
I've actually got a question for you, Hayley and V. You say that you built community from your first Kickstarter onwards. How did you go about getting up off the ground to that first Kickstarter?
So our first Kickstarter wasn't that significant in the number of people who backed it. So I don't think it was a particularly unattainable goal to reach. But at that point, I think that the mainstay of people had come from sort of, we'd run a lot of conventions, at a lot of conventions prior to that time. And we'd also like created a number of like micro games that we had up on our website. So just little silly experiences. Like we had one called The Ghost of NPCs Past, where it's like a Halloween game where any NPC that had been killed in your game, you could kind of like, they came back as a ghost, what do they want to say to you? And like little games like that, which people had been sort of picked up and maybe given a go, and yeah, that kind
right,
of.
So start small and build.
Yeah, very small, yeah.
What other conventions were you attending? Because, you know, I knew about PAX, and then just as a fan, I sort of vaguely knew about like Armageddon and NovaCore, is that one? I can't even remember. NovaCon. Anyway, I didn't know about Conquest, which is a Melbourne tabletop around Easter time convention. I didn't know about that until more recently. There's some in Sydney and New South Wales, as far as I'm aware. What conventions were you going to try to show off your games? You know,
there's really small ones. Like, I think our first ones were SidCon. There's Fino, in Canberra, that they have like real small stuff as well, like community halls, school halls, like not packs is what I mean,
yeah,
was
yeah.
what we started doing.
Because it's worth researching, like what are the cons in your area. James, I know you've been attending and finding people at some conventions in the States the last 12 months in particular.
When it comes to the advice of start small, I mean, it really applies to everything. And that includes start with small cons too, because if you have something small to show to people, being at a smaller con where things are less hectic means that you can form something of a relationship with the people who come by your booth, who come and look at your thing. You can talk with them. You can kind of understand who they are. You can see what kind of person is drawn to the things that you create. Is it just people who think very similarly to you, or is there someone with different tastes who's glommed onto what you're offering for a reason totally outside of what you thought was the core appeal, or more just like, you know, tangential to the core appeal. And there's a similar divide between cons that are consumer focused and industry focused, whereas PAX often has kind of a mix of both, right? This is kind of an industry focused panel at a largely consumer focused con.
Sure.
But the con that has become my favorite back in the States is Big Bad Con, which is very, very small. I think it's less than 1,000 people come through the entire weekend.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Man, it is, like, its reputation is quickly out.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's also, yeah, you're right.
Yeah,
it's
sold out at 1,000 people this year. But yeah, for Australian standards, that's a big con.
I'm talking, like, a community hall, right?
Yeah. But I bring up Big Bad Con, right? Everything's bigger in America, right? I bring up Big Bad Con because it's the clearest example of a super industry-focused con.
Sure.
I'm sure there are people who come by Big Bad Con just to play games, but the vast majority of what goes on there are highly focused events that get creative professionals in the same room as one another, that get the POC scholars who do not typically have the same connections as, you know, cis white het male authors who typically dominate the space into creative and leadership positions, right? This is a con with a goal, a professional goal. Mm-hmm. And there are cons just like that, you know, all over the world. As usual, it's very America dominated because that's just the nature of the RPG industry. But if you do some hunting, you can find cons like that, I'm sure, even over here.
Yeah, I feel like even some of the smaller ones, when you do have a bit more time, it does give you an opportunity to go around, play everyone else's game and actually meet your peers and actually meet people who are thinking of designing similarly or differently to you. And that does develop you, I think, as a game designer a lot.
Yeah.
Or whatever you do, whatever part of the field that you're in.
Well, I think that comes into the question of marketing too, because The community support is the main way that a lot of these games, if they're big or small, get off the ground.
We do, if folks have them, want to take some questions. We have a microphone over here and a microphone over here. We also have an enforcer with a microphone, I believe, if you prefer. I want to ask another question before we do that, but if you want to start making your way, if you have a question, over to one microphone or the other. I wanted to ask, Phil, I know that you had some experience with this at Ghostfire in particular, but potentially when you were freelancing as well. And Haley, you mentioned this before as something that you kind of take care of is the manufacturing side of things, the actually making the books, which is something like, I don't know, create a PDF, upload, done, you know? How does that process happen?
Ooh, well, yeah, look, that's, I guess, the production side of things. Yes, you've got a great book, you've done your layout and everything, but then you've got to sort of, I guess, you'd find a printer that will work with you with the amount of printing you want to do, mm-hmm. whether it's print on demand or something right. along those lines, which is always a good inroad into physical print publishing, mm-hmm. Because there's not a massive, not massive stake in it from a financial point of view as well.
Gotcha.
And then you got to understand, I guess, what the printers want from you. And that's a whole nother level of layout design that a lot of indie creators have to learn on the fly.
Sure.
And it takes a few times back and forth to get that right and understand what CMYK coloring is and things like that, right? And how to lay out a book so it's going to print the way you want it to print. So going through those processes, sending it off to the printer, bouncing back and forth a few times, getting it right, and we'll finally print this book, you get a test print, and then you've got to go through it. And you'll find every single typo that you've made that only appear visible in physical form. So then you go through that, and then you go through another editing process and send it off again. Your final files, get it back, more issues with it again. And so it's a very much a back and forth process until you finally get it to a point where you're like, well, something a good friend once told me was a book is, or a project is never truly finished, it merely escapes.
Right.
So you get it to a point where, yeah, you know what, it's ready.
Yeah.
And you'll see that, look, you'll see that in Wizards of the Coast books and everything, you'll find typos in there. That's because there's only so much you can prove these things before it starts becoming not worth doing it further from a business sense. And then things just slip through as well.
Yeah, for sure.
They just do. So you get it to that point and then it's finally ready.
Gotcha.
And then you've got to start thinking about how you're going to get it into people's hands.
Hayley, is that your experience as well?
Yeah, that very much that manufacturing experience very much reflects our own. Lucky to have V who understands the print specifications. If you are working with a good graphic designer, they can often help you through a lot of that as right. well. We tend to use offset print runs, which means that you do like print a bigger quality, and that tends to have advantages in that you can have more control over the product you create and the quality of it as well. And if you look around at different offset printers, they'll have different minimums, but it is possible to find one that might only have a minimum of like a few hundred copies as well. A lot of my job comes into getting them in people's hands and shipping and distribution. And from Australia, we do have the challenging edition of this for sure. One thing that has been helpful for us is to partner with a distributor in the States.
Okay.
Because we do a lot of our sales in the US, the majority of them are actually there. And so people from the US, unsurprisingly, aren't too thrilled. And it's like, well, it's $50 to ship it to you from Australia. partnering with them has just allowed us to bring down the cost per like for their shipping. But if that is another advantage of printing on demand, as Phil is mentioning, that would print from a facility that could be anywhere in the world. So you could be printing from the US and then sending directly to a US customer with that too. So if you are working in really small quantities, that can help solve your shipping woes. And that is what we did in our very first Kickstarter as well.
Gotcha. All right, let us, we've got a couple of people who want to ask a question. So let's open it up over here first.
If you could give one piece of advice to your younger self about what you'll do, what would it be?
Ooh. Well, don't start with me.
Be more confident in myself. Trust that you can enjoy yourself, do the work that you're doing. And as long as you're open to opportunities along the way, it'll be okay. It'll turn out fine. So give it a go.
This is going to sound like a silly one, but play your own games for fun and not just work.
Yes.
Forget why they're fun, and that is really going to make it a hard time for you to design well.
No.
But playing them for fun is really helpful.
I hugely agree with that. I make sure, I mean, it's not advice that my younger self needed because it's advice that I gave my younger self, but it was, I still make sure I have a home 5e game that I play nearly every week to make sure I'm still connected with the reason that I want to create for it. And in tandem with that, if you're a forever GM, make sure to play as often as you can so that you remember what it's like on the other side of the screen, because you can forget. Phil, James, anything you want to add?
Yeah, I can go. When you turn your hobby into a job, be sure to also get new hobbies. It's kind of like the tangential to what you're doing, perpendicular
yes.
to yours. But boy, did I start to hate D&D like 2 years ago. Oh my God. It wasn't until I started like cultivating houseplants in my home. There's like, oh my God, finally, another hobby that I can pour my love into.
Yeah, I got into wargaming.
So. Yeah.
Yeah. For me, I think it's start small. Don't think too big on your first few things because you may run out of steam until you build up, like we said, until you build up that confidence. When you've got that confidence, it's a lot easier to plow through those late nights just hacking away at your keyboard. But when you don't, it can be challenging. So start small.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Jumping over here, yes.
Hi. Speaking on graphic design and thinking of the food metaphor, the first bite is with the eye. How high would you value presentation of the products for a new creator?
Presentation is really important, I think. Everyone's nodding, yes.
Yeah.
I think you want to be putting your best foot forward there. Especially now it's, you know, there's more and more products coming out every year, and you want to make sure that you're putting effort across everything so that you are, and you know, when you're starting out, maybe you can't, and that's fine. It's better to have something done and then improve, like release it and improve over it over time. But do invest a little bit, even if it's one high quality piece of art for the cover. Or even if it's finding a template for a graphic design using Canva or something like that, just to make something neat, a bit more polished than you know, whatever it is, just take one small step towards it. And you can keep learning in your iterations.
Yeah.
Have it in the back of your mind.
I agree. I don't want this answer to give anybody necessarily anxiety, but I think that some of the success of Ghostfire early on was that something that the company went into as a bit of a mandate was, we make high quality products that are going to look as good, if not a little bit better, than Wizards of the Coast books. And largely they do, you know, we're really proud of the content that we've created from a presentation standpoint. The paper feels good, the cover looks great, they're all hardcover books. And I think that's what really made us stand out as a company. We're still really young, you know. We're not Kobold Press in terms of age. We're only 3 or 4 years. But a lot of that success has been just from making sure that our presentation was as good as it can be. I agree with Phil's advice from a moment ago of, like, start small. If you can't, for whatever reason, get to that quality, I don't want to give people anxiety that they need to produce books of that production value necessarily. But presentation can help you stand out from, you know, what else is happening.
And I want to step in and provide sort of a counterpoint to that, which is a book that's done is better than a book that isn't done.
I agree.
If you get hung up on this sort of thing, then you'll never publish and you'll never iterate and you'll never like keep getting better.
Yep.
So yes, absolutely. Hit the polish as hard as you can reasonably with the skill and resources you have right now, and then get out of the way.
Don't let perfect be the enemy of good.
Or finished.
Yes.
Let it escape.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right, let's jump over here.
So there's been a fair bit of talk from companies as big as Wizards on down about freelancing and getting freelancers involved in writing and graphic design and stuff. The question's probably pitched more towards the story brewers just because it's a little more of an indie style thing. At what stage do you think something has grown large enough that you're at the point we need freelancers to do this? This is not something that we can do ourselves. You wear a lot of hats. At what point do you give the hat to someone else?
Yeah, so there's two considerations there's three considerations from our point of view. I guess the first one is just like, do we have the budget to pay people fairly to do this? Because if you don't have the budget to pay people fairly, then you should not be hiring freelancers. You're going to have to do it yourself. The second question is this something that we can do to a standard that will satisfy us for this particular project? Remembering that starting small meant that many things that we could do, you know, for our little project to a standard that satisfied ourselves, as we went further, we wanted to get freelancers on board for that. So editing is one of those, like with our very first project, we're like, we can do it, just we'll get the typos, we'll just go over it 5 billion times. And then, you know, with later projects, we were like, yeah, we're in danger. So you can kind of build up in that way. And the third thing is just simply, if you find yourself, the thought of doing a particular thing kind of like makes you stall on a project completely or really, really slow down, and that's not something that you'd ever want to like super engage with or learn, then that's a good cue to use a freelancer, because there's no point like spending a really long time with a project battling through something that is something that someone else can do in a way that actually turns out to be more monetarily beneficial for you, because it means your project is done and finished and out in the world.
Yeah. I think that it is also important to use that as an opportunity to think about like strategically, what do you want to do yourself to learn specifically, because doing it will help you learn, and what definitely you're not interested in learning. And the other thing is finding good people to work with is also in your interest in the future, because having good collaborators, you know, between one project and the next can be a great source of blessing and joy in your life. Yes.
Yes.
Please.
Even as someone who typically works for corporate clients, I've found that I'm a game designer. I think in terms of resources a lot. There are three resources that I always think of as being vital to spend during a product, and they are money, of course, time, and stress. And you want to make sure that, you know, you never overspend your budget on any of those three things, right? And I can spend time to save myself money. I can spend money to save myself time. And if I run out of both of those things, I can crunch and spend a lot of stress. But like, you can run out of those things really, really easily. And if you spend too much of that stress, you will burn out. And then it doesn't matter how much time or money you have, you just won't be able to create anymore.
Over this side.
Given you guys ultimately have to think in terms of business, what generally gives you the faith to take your good idea into something you want to produce? You've got a number of vectors, i.e. like you've got your social media presence, you're going to convention, you've got your own professional judgment. Do any of those weigh in more heavily as to, you know, go as far as, you know, Balakin plans and aberrations, kind of like what sort of was the tipping point to go that's where we want to go next?
I think that, you know, as you're thinking of your marketing strategy, something that I learned recently from a YouTube perspective, which is a lot of what I do for the company, is think of the thumbnail first and then write your video to that thumbnail, because the thumbnail is what's going to get people to click and actually stick around. And that sounds incredibly cynical when I heard that advice. And that's not necessarily what I'm saying we do with our products. We're not like thinking of the cover first and then writing the book to that. But, you know, marketing is coming up with a good story as to not just what this product is about, but why it exists and why you need it, right?
What's the hook?
Yeah, exactly that. So For this panel, we wanted people to come along and, we're using it as an episode of our podcast, but the value that we're giving, what we decided was going to get people in this room, is the knowledge that we can share around, this industry and people who might want to try to find their way into it. And so for our products, I wasn't strictly in the room for Valica itself. Maybe Phil, you could answer that a little bit better.
Why did we choose Valica? Is that the question?
Honestly, I think it was just because we were like, Vikings, yeah! For the board games and Aberration, we were like, we want to do a board game, and the story of that is that we are changing our setting, our point of difference, our unique Grim Hollow story into a new format. If we did Brimbolo for our first board game, nobody would necessarily care, but people who are invested in Grim Hollow, hopefully, if they also like board games, will find Aberration interesting. I suppose that's the hope. V, Haley, do you have anything you want to?
I mean, I think we've always made like upbeat role-playing games, and that is sort of our thing. And so I feel for us, it's like how much we love the project and how much we're enjoying working in that. And we just trust and believe that we will find our people and our people will find us.
Yeah,
people who like that particular weird thing that we have made.
Yeah, I tend to imagine myself playing the finished version of the game, not like what any of the rules would be like or anything, but just imagining myself, I'm playing the game and I'm like, am I having fun in my imagination? If my imagination is like, whoa, this sucks, then that's like, nope. If me and my imagination is like, I'm into this, I'm like, all right, I'm into this.
I think also something that it sounds like you may have done is stay true to your original self as well. Mm-hmm. And so the people who were with you from the beginning follow along with that, and they respond to that as well.
It's hard when you're just two people to not be yourself. Right. You're in the echo chamber of, this is fun, right? Like, put gay fairies on the front cover of our box, right? No one's going to stop us from doing that, right? Yeah, okay, let's do that. So I think we just have our own perspective usually, and that's what drives us forward.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
People love authenticity, right? Mm. I love it when I'm authentic to myself. And the people who read my stuff love it when I'm authentic to myself. And if I'm following some, sort of cynical, marketing-driven corporate mandate, then unless I find something really authentic in it, I'm not going to make a good game.
Sure.
And luckily, I've never been put in the position where I have to do something that, like, grinds my soul into the dust.
I think, for 5e specifically, which is what Ghostfire does a lot of, it's finding gaps in the game that we want to fill because we find it fun, but it's also answering other people's kind of needs as well. So for Grim Hollow, it was dark fantasy. I love dark fantasy. Mm-hmm. 5e at its base doesn't feel very dark fantasy, but Grim Hollow fills that need. For Twisted Taverns, it was like, Tavern is a mainstay of fantasy role-playing games. Here's 12 of them that you can drop into any kind of setting. And that's the story of the product in addition to what the product is. Does that make sense? Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jumping over to this side. This might be the last one because we are right on 8:59. So I apologize. But we'll be around to chat if people want to.
Phil, you mentioned that creators tend to forget that business pillar when it comes to pushing their products out there.
Yeah.
With the experience that you guys have had now, would you recommend to new creators to make those same mistakes, face the same complications, or would you recommend collaborating with more business-minded like people to help them with that?
Ooh. It's a great question. Hard question. I think I probably wouldn't be where I am at the moment without having made those mistakes early in the piece and learning from those mistakes. But I think it's definitely important. I wish I had have known these things earlier as well, without having to have gone through some of those mistakes as well. So I think, it's good to stumble and learn along the way, but I think it's also good to not necessarily reach out to business people or anything like that, but be aware and learn.
You say that there are mentors out there, like we've been having James and Sean, in terms of this pushing this product through a business, like looking through those avenues and channels rather than looking for other people who might just have blanket experience in marketing.
Yes, when early in the piece, like when you are learning, it's probably not, I wouldn't personally advise to reach out to marketing teams, marketing people straight away. I would learn from doing early in the piece. Make the mistakes early.
And with low risk.
And with low risk. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you all for joining us today. Thank you, Pax, for letting us do this panel. And thank you to my co-hosts. If you enjoyed this chat, for those that don't know, we have a weekly podcast called the Eldritch Lorecast. You can find it on any audio platform where the number one RPG podcast can be found, because it's us. Wink, nod. And we're also on YouTube as well. So wherever you prefer to find us, my name's been Ben Byrne, here with James Haig, Phil Beckwith, V. Hendro, Haley Gordon, and we will hopefully catch you all next week. We're not doing the music, Dante. We're not doing it. For those who know, they're going to kick us out. We can't stay here forever. You have to stop recording eventually.
This is all going to be
from last episode.
Thanks so much for joining us, everyone.
Bubba up.